Hello, coconuts. Welcome to another episode of TFC Stock Geek Out. Today, I'm excited to introduce a company that is disrupting the money transfer space by making it extremely cheap and easy to transfer money overseas. The best part? They've been growing at a pretty amazing rate, over 30% over the last few years. And surprisingly, their cash flow and operating profit positive. This is rarely seen in high growth sectors and something most investors will love because it contains the double happiness of high growth and healthy profits. Joining me today is Eugene Ng, Chief Investment Officer and also founder of Vision Capital. Eugene believes in buying high quality companies that represent our ideal vision of the future. One of his investing philosophies is to find excellence, buy excellence, and hold on to excellence. Let's dive in today's episode on TransferWise with Eugene Ng. For reference, this episode was recorded on 27th August, 2022. Our discussion today is solely for education and entertainment purposes. It does not serve as any form of advice or recommendations. Thank you for loving what we do and empowering us financially to do more for you. Now, let's geek out.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, hello. So welcome to today's Stock Geek Out with the Financial Coconut. So we have an amazing guest and a good friend of mine. His name is called Eugene Ng from Vision Capital. I believe Eugene is the founder and also the chief investment officer of Vision Capital. So without further ado, I'll let Eugene do a bit of introduction of himself.
Hi, Max. It's good to be back to the Financial Coconut as well. And I think I've been doing a couple of stock geek outs as well. Yep. I think no stranger to the team, but I'm an individual investor based out in Singapore. Yep. So I've been investing for close to about five over years. I guess have a okay track record. I think really just focusing on really investing in companies that best reflect our vision for our future that is changing and shaping the world for the better. And I think payments is something that is extremely dear to me. I've been in the finance industry for over 12 years. I think doing FX for almost 12 years. So this is something that is very dear, and that's why I think that brought us to this company actually.
Got it. So yeah, I was trying to think of a nice jumping off, diving in point the last few days. And I think just to give the listeners or you coconuts a little bit of background. So Eugene's a good friend of mine also. So I've been very excited. So in case this podcast is a little bit more informal than usual, it's because yeah, we kind of know each other for a while. And Eugene is one of like the most nerdy, crazy, intense investors I've ever met. And of course, I know your background is also, like you mentioned, you have a lot of FX background. Your own 9-to-5 job has a lot of financial background in there. So I just want to pick a nice jumping off point. So how in the world did you come across TransferWise in the first place? What's the backstory? How did this gem come about?
Yeah. So I think for me, I've been making, I guess, a fair bit of cross-border payments. So what I do is a fair bit of angel investing as well. So when I write checks to invest in early startups, typically those are in US dollars. So me being based out in Singapore, I was trying to find a good and cheap solution for me to do that, those FX and basically timely send my money across and to the rounds across, right? So I think when I was chancing upon the cheapest one, instead of trying to use my banks, like Citibank, which was charging 3-4% on all of those fees, and you have no idea when the funds are going to reach the other counterparty, I happened to chance upon TransferWise. So I've been using TransferWise for almost 3-4 years now, actually. So I've been a regular user of them. So I use them not only to make payments, I use them to collect all of my rental for my overseas properties, and then they convert back into Sing. For example, for my book, right? I have proceeds depending on where the books get sold across the world in different currencies.
Yes, that's right.
They get automatically get collected in my TransferWise account. And then when I only need to do is one click, it transfers back into Sing into my Sing account.
Sweet.
So like I use it for like, you know, pay in, pay out, collecting of payments, and that's also when the IPO last year, I was like, oh wow, I really need to look at this company because it is and the fees, and best of it, the fees were really low. And so, when the fees was low and at mid rates, and I do FX, you know, I guess for a living, and when I know that you can do it at mid rates and the fees are extremely transparent, there is something special behind it. And if they can make money, you'll be, and profitable is even better. So when I look at the financials, I was like, oh wow, this truly was a gem.
So I love it because, like you mentioned, you kind of discovered the company just through your own daily life or work, even years before they did the direct listing, right? Because this company came on by direct listing, not the normal IPO way. So I guess, let's jump in a bit deeper based on what you're saying. So how, or maybe let's kind of backtrack a little bit. What was the founding of the company's backstory like? Because I think a little bit of research that I do, the founders are from none other than Skype.
Yes.
Okay, which has kind of become a lot more old school today. But yeah, how did two founders that started a telecommunications company or media company, which is Skype, how did they end up starting a payments company?
This was a really interesting story. I mean, the two co-founders was basically Christoph and Tavet. Mm-hmm. They were actually both working in London. Now, the interesting thing was that Christoph himself was actually, at the time, he was actually at Deloitte. So it's actually paid in sterling. Mm. And Tavet himself was at Skype and he was paid in euros. Now, what happens was that Christoph was paid in sterling. He needed to actually get euros because in Estonia, it's a very part of the euro and they need to pay for his fees.
Yep.
So what happens that, and then Tavet basically, he himself needed sterling because he's in London. He needs sterling for his living expenses. So like these two guys, and I don't want to like, cross the FX and say they agreed on the mint rate every month, and they basically ended up Christoph will basically pay sterling to Tavet and transfer to his account in London, and Tavet basically will transfer the euro to Christoph's account in Estonia and pay for his housing installment loans. And then when they realized, oh okay, that's something that's doable, and then they started expanding this same thing to more groups of friends, and they realized this internalization of capital became so important. And that really, that started grew bigger and bigger, and it started building really from there.
Yeah, I'm going to like kind of, I love it because when I first heard this story as well, it was, I think, part of their founding video that's very popular on their YouTube channel. It's kind of like the founding story. So let me just get this straight. It's these two founders who are good friends. One of them earns in certain currency. Another one earns in a different currency. And when they want to transfer money to each other for whatever reason, they don't want the money to cross the border because once it crosses the border, it involves the banks, which takes a certain sizable cut, which they just die don't want to give away. So they kind of use each other's local banks to kind of arbitrage this and to kind of circumvent the money out of the country. So actually the money still stays in the country. Is that what you're saying?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So that's my question. I want to go in deeper. So this is possible if I know you and you know me, but how did they scale this to the point where, let's say, they can now have so many different business customers or even small, medium enterprise, which is their main bulk of the customer base. We'll get into that later. How are they able to have so many different money pools across different parts of the world? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. And secondly, isn't this also clonable by, let's say, a PayPal? I can just also do different liquidity pools around the world and ta-da, I've cloned it. So let's get to the first question first. How did they make this doable? Yeah.
Okay. I think really is key is when they found out that there was a solution. So what happens is that when you realize in the FX world and the cross-border payments, there are people with different needs. And as they start growing this, they started discovering more and more people with the same needs.
Mm-hmm.
And when the product exploded, you were matching constantly needs. So after a while, actually, you realize in the entire FX world, like I give you an example. If someone was, if a Filipino overseas worker was working in the US, they would consistently have to pay, send Philippine pesos every month.
Yep.
It doesn't really change. Mm. So like in Christoph's way, right, he needed to just pay his Estonian housing loan. He needed to do that every month. So after a while, you realize a lot of the payments, they can be ad hoc if you're doing e-commerce purchase, but it can also be very recurring depending on that nature.
That's
and
true.
when it comes to a confluence of that. Now in every country there are going to be surplus or deficit in terms of where some of these remittances or some of these overseas payments come, depending on that. But that's really the founding block. And when they started expanding throughout globally around the world, those cross confluence of those needs really came in together. And I think that's really where they just found their sweet spot. And so right now, I think they had a matrix which was about 50. The majority actually of their flows are actually internalized.
Yes.
Which means the beauty of this is that you don't have to go through the entire payment rails. Like just now you shared, right? When you go through a payment rail, first, the banks earn an FX rate. You don't know what the FX rate is upfront. It's typically anywhere from 3 to 5%.
Yeah, there's historically a little bit of non-transparency.
And then you have those fees that go on top. Now, with this, you know all that. Because what happens is that you don't need to do an FX. You agree at the mid rate, which is the most transparent rate possible.
Mm.
And then basically you pay the fees literally from doing their local payment transfers. And that's literally what happens. So I think when they build those, the toughest bit of this, and that's really the most enduring bit, is the moat. The moat in the sense of building that local infrastructure. Payments infrastructure, you think it's seemingly easy, it's actually very difficult.
Mm.
When you get regulatory approvals to set up certain things and you do it, that it takes very long. So like, for example, for them, they took over eight and a half years. They spent about $800 million to build this.
Because they will need the different cash funds or liquidity pools, which is what we call it, to be set up in the different countries. So each of these setups will take some red tape and logistical nightmares to go through to set it up. Am I right?
Exactly. And when someone sets it up and makes the payment, it has to go through smoothly without any manual intervention. That whole process, it's insanely crazy. And it really, once you build it, becomes extremely scalable. And that's really, that whole driver of that. So they found it, firstly, at the individual level. Now, because I want you to look at the whole payments, cross-border payments market, right? So there are three payments market. One is enterprise. Enterprise are your top tier, very big, largest companies.
That's right.
They need to do FX. The amount of FX that they do is typically about 50% of the market. But the margins are typically, I can tell you because I used to do a lot of that, and they're less than 10 basis points, or even more than that. And they account for about 5% of the entire TAM of revenue to be earned, even though they account for 50% of the volumes.
Mm.
And a lot of the enterprise, when they do all that, it's not just spot trades. I mean spot trades meaning an FX that you do, has to be settled, say, in 2 days from now.
Yes.
They do a lot, could be doing forward hedging, 1 year, 6 months, 2 years, and doing a fair bit of that, which requires bank FX lines, ISDAs, credit lines to do all that, which TransferWise does not operate.
Mm.
And should not want to operate because, to be honest, it's something that is dominated by the institutional banks who need large balance sheets to do all of that. Now, if you take out the enterprise, that comes down two markets. One, you have the individual market. And two, you have the small, medium business market.
Which is TransferWise.
Which is what TransferWise is. Correct. Now, so what TransferWise actually started on the individual side, they found that niche and they found it to be extremely strong. And then after that, they realized, a lot of consumers started using it and started doing it faster.
Yep.
And then after that, when they started going up and then found the next market, which could obviously was also the largest TAM. So like, I think if you look at, for example, in terms of TAM-wise, individuals account for about 2 trillion in terms of global FX volume. SMBs is about three and a half times larger, about 7 trillion.
Yes.
Right? The revenue of SMB is about 2 times that of individuals. So the global TAM is around 120 billion or so.
Mm.
So it's still very, very large. So they found out, and actually the take rates, right? I mean, or rather the margins on SMBs is about 1%.
Yes, which is higher than the enterprise.
Which is much higher than enterprise. So so there is a sweet spot, you see.
Correct.
And when you do all of these transactions, typically they're all cash funded, meaning the cash has to be in the account, done the FX conversion, and then the funds are sent. So actually what happens is that you mitigate a lot of credit risk, which the banks, they themselves cannot do with SMBs. Or small, medium price business, because you need credit lines in order to do all of this. So becoming or really expanding from individual down to small, medium businesses, they really just found that niche and they're growing. And right now, you can see in the latest financials, the SMB business is growing much faster than even the individual business.
Yep.
And the per clip size for SMBs are almost 5 to 6 times larger than that, right?
Correct.
And the take rates are quite similar. I think individual take rates are about 60 basis points. SMBs about 60 basis points.
Mm.
So just 10 basis points lower. So the take rates are not that much lower. They're much larger on a per transaction basis. Right. And you can see their growth.
The cool part I thought was pretty cool was like, not only are they actually bypassing a lot of these middlemen, but their take rates and their revenues are increasing along with the volumes. But their take rates have been declining across the years, right? So you know, in investing, there's this thing that we kind of always talk about, which is the ability to do right by the customer. It's called like win-win-win. So not only does the customer win, the business win. So they are able to make more profits, but yet the take rate is going down, which we'll get into it later, probably along the economies of scale. scale part. I also want to dive in a bit deeper. So this is the claim that I saw during my research to prepare for this, right? Mm. That is, they stated that, or TransferWise states that their price is 8 times cheaper on average than what leading traditional UK banks do. And in their investor presentation, I can't recall the exact number. They also pegged themselves a lot to PayPal by saying that we are also way cheaper than PayPal in terms of the take rate and commission. So earlier on, you mentioned this point, and that is like, you know, there's a lot of red tape to set up these different liquidity pools in different countries. But hey, why can't a PayPal and a leading bank institution in UK also go do that? Because these guys also have strings they can pull. These guys are big organizations. So in a way, we're getting into the moat down here already. So what is stopping the bigger boy? So maybe for a small player to do that, it's hard. But what's stopping a bigger boy like PayPal to come in and do that? Yeah.
PayPal used to be able to do that, and they started off really with like the eBay business. So they had all these local pools of liquidity as well, which they do manage on their treasury side as well. But the interesting thing about PayPal is when you make a payment, most of the time when you're making a payment to someone, you're using your credit cards. And that inherently already has the cost. You can't escape from it. Because you're using your credit card and your credit card
which is tied to the bank.
So that 3-4% you have to pay no matter what. And then PayPal charges, you know, extra on top to the merchants for that. Well, now PayPal has this great stuff, right? Because it acts as a trust and as a checkout button, you know, it enables people, and with one click they can do it. Now PayPal does it largely for e-commerce, but PayPal really is the enabler for e-commerce more than for cross-border payments.
Yes.
Because for cross-border payments, if I want to make a transfer, I have to use my credit card to pay. And if I have to pay 3-4%, why do I use something else, right? And I think that's really that mode. And ultimately, PayPal side, you have to cross the border because of that, right? And the bit on banks, right? Why can't banks, I guess, really do this? Because you need to build the technology stack. Banks, when we're doing FX, we are doing interbank settlements with customers making large payments. And this is something I want to go through, right? You don't realize that actually the current payments landscape is actually really outdated. The SWIFT payment is really outdated. So let me try to give you an example, right?
Okay.
Now let's say I do an FX to sell dollar and buy euros.
Okay.
To send to your account in London, and I'm based out, say, in Singapore. What I need to do is that I need to give my dollars to the FX bank over here.
Mm.
They need to send to their US correspondent bank.
Yes.
Okay. And then after that, so let's put it this way. Let's send euros, for example. Okay. So when we send euros here, the banks bought the euros over here. They need to first send the euros over to the correspondent bank on the other side, which you're receiving. So let's say, for example, you're receiving in Barclays, London. Yeah.
So that's the first layer.
Yeah. So, and Barclays, London, so they say happen to be there. They are the euro clearing bank. So I need to send to Barclays, London. And then Barclays, London needs to then basically on send back to the penny bank. And then after that, gets credited. So when you have many, many different layers of this what we call correspondent banks, right?
Each layer takes a card. Nice.
Each layer is slow. And you know what? It takes time. Because in the traditional payment system, it's a bathtub concept. The funds come in, there are funds, the funds get paid out.
Mm.
The funds do not come in, the funds do not really get paid out before they come in.
Yeah.
So actually with this, you have actually bypassed every single... So you can imagine, like the majority right now, TransferWise, I think, has the latest statistic, which is around, if I'm correct, about 52% of their transfers are now instant. And 90% within 24 hours.
Correct. That was the statistic.
You have 52% that is instant?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is insane because I can tell you, if you do enterprise FX...
2-5 days.
No, enterprise FX, you can settle within the same day if I'm doing it.
Okay.
But it takes hours.
Okay.
No, I can tell you, no enterprise FX when you're being done, when you're sending a payment,
it's
within 5 minutes. So, I like if I want to pay Thai baht, you know, to an account in Thailand, I literally could make the transfer, and if I open, say, my signed commercial bank there, and I will see the Thai baht being credited. I can tell you, no one else can do it.
Got it. And actually, that was the part that I was pretty mind-blown because they have this chart in their investor presentation. So yeah, you're actually spot on, right? 50% of Wise payments, which is TransferWise, are instant. 88% arrive within 24 hours. And then they mentioned, in contrast, a bank wire transfer takes 2-5 business days. So that is like way, way longer. And so the mechanics of this is because the money never leaves the country. So in a way, let's say just now your example, you wanted to transfer a certain amount, and that amount really in the traditional banking system really leaves your system and then goes to the bank side. And then from there, there's multiple layers. Each layer takes a small card. Mm. And then after that, transfer. But at the TransferWise way is whatever you want to transfer, they kind of know the amount, and then they find that country that you wanted to transfer that currency to, and they find that local pool of liquidity for that currency, and they just do a transfer in that country to the other bank account. Right?
And the most powerful thing about this is really network effects. The more users they have in each country, the greater the pools of liquidity, because you then have the more users you have in the UK, you have more sterling, because maybe people need to sell sterling and make other transfers.
Yep.
And whereas if for some people wants to, you know, then transfer sterling inside there, that is it. So there are very strong inherent network effects. Of course, you must have the timing, because that must happen. But the market is so large, and if you look at it, TransferWise is nearly about 1% penetration of the global
it's early days,
so
baby.
It is really early days, and they have shown that progress.
And will you say, like, because of the network effects to what you're saying, so the more users want to use that, the more it becomes more popular. So the bigger the float pool of money in that currency stays there, which allows them to earn from that float. So is that like a significant part of their earnings at this point, or what?
This is very interesting, because I think when TransferWise first started, majority of their revenues were actually conversion income or FX conversion income.
Okay.
And basically the fees that you charge on top of that.
Yes.
So let's just keep it as conversion revenues, right?
Yeah.
But what happens so is that when now a lot of the users and the customers are actually allowed to have accounts with TransferWise. And TransferWise are actually not allowed to pay interest on those accounts because they're not deposits. And as in a rising interest rate environment, especially, you might think some bad for a lot of number of companies, it's actually good for TransferWise, because they have what we call float. Yes. And when you have float, you actually earn interest income. Float, and you can see in the latest earnings, they have actually started reporting interest income in addition to, and it's figuring out, okay, now we have actually have more income, and we're deciding, okay, can we lower the fees of our customers?
Yes.
Can we give them other, can we invest in other things? Can we then do other stuff? So that becomes, it's like really what we call like scale economic shed. You're adding it into other different stuff, right? And I think that's really the beauty of it.
So the mindset here is they are actually looking to give it back to the customer, you know, unlike
they can keep it they can give it back, but I think they're always thinking about what really is driving the customer. Right?
Okay, got it. So I think this is a very good transition time to for the listeners listening. Let's go a little bit into the numbers or the financials first, right? So that there's something for them to latch on. So maybe we can just talk about the top line first in terms of how much is the top line like in growth, and then we can go further down the income statement.
Yeah. So I think the top line, if you look at the full year 22 revenue number, the revenue number is around 560 million pounds.
Right.
I think they did roughly, if I'm correct, I don't have roughly the number, but if I look at the full year 23 number, I think they should come in excess of 100 billion pounds, roughly on 35% growth rates, which the company is guiding.
Yep.
So at 100 billion transaction volumes that are moving, they are not a small player. They clearly know how to move money, and they have clearly done it well, right? The full year 22 growth rates were at 33%.
Yes,
That was that, and their full year 23 revenue guide was between 30-35%.
And the margins are pretty, I would say, what's a good word? Pretty sick as well, right? So they are actually profitable on both like a free cash flow basis and even an operating gap.
It's not even non-gap,
It's not even non-gap, which is what we're very used to looking at as growth investors. So I don't want to talk a bit about that, right? So like, so the margin profile actually improved. I'm looking at 2021 financial year. Gross margin was 62%. Last year was 66%. I think, so just to share a bit of background, I'm very impressed by businesses where they can improve their revenue and margin, but yet they decrease the take rates for the customers. So what's going on? Can we like kind of pull the curtain back? How was that doable?
This really goes into the concept, right? I think Nick Sleep of Normac Capital really goes into really skilled economic shed. I think what happens is that when you build all of this, you find that a lot of the infrastructure is fixed. So there's immense operating leverage in the business. When you build the infrastructure already, ultimately, when more volumes go through,
all
you need is computing power and cloud, right?
Yeah.
So that really goes through, and what they can say, okay, you know, we don't need to make so much money. We can make enough money. We can let our margins rise a little here and there, but you don't need to let it rise or to be too greedy.
Mm-hmm.
And we give it back to our customers by lowering the take rates. And if customers are happy, they're delighted by the cost and what we have given them, and keep improving on it. It's a win-win situation.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I think that's truly, truly one of the biggest things. Like, yeah.
So I think let's kind of, for a little bit of newer coconuts, if you're a bit of a younger, newer investor. So what you're kind of describing is like a positive flywheel, a little bit like the, I think Costco was the first and then followed by Amazon that has this skill economy shared. So what's happening is down here, even though they have very fixed cost that's fixed, and then their income increases because there's operating leverage, instead of keeping it for themselves, they reinvest it back to the customer through certain infrastructure. So just by increasing the timing, R&D, the timing, lowering the timing to receive the money, or basically just reducing the take rate, that increases the customer volume and transactions, which then allows them to continue reinvesting back into the business. So that's called skill economy share. Am I right?
Yes. And something very, very interesting. So as you said, their gross profit margins are around 66%, right?
Yeah.
Their adjusted EBITDA margins are probably around 22%.
Yes, that's right,
22%. No, their free cash flow margins are 20%.
Yeah.
What you don't realize is that their free cash flow conversion margins over adjusted EBITDA is almost 90%+.
Oh, yes.
Which means they actually don't need much capex.
Yeah, correct. So like 90% of their earnings is in cash. Yeah, so which means the capex is like sub 10%, right? So you're just wondering actually what do they really need to invest in? Yeah, cool. And speaking of that, right, like speaking of the flywheel, of the customer flywheel, I also saw this, which was pretty mind-blowing. 66%, this is from the investor relation, 66% of new customers to TransferWise are referred. Let me just repeat that one more time. 66% of new customers are referred. So this is their marketing spend. It's still there, obviously, because it's still a young company, but it is organic. So why is it so popular? Is it just because it's really the costs are so dirt cheap and I'm getting as a consumer like really like the spot rate or close to the spot rate?
Yeah. I think for me, for example, I probably must have done 10 to 20 TransferWise referrals on my own over the last couple of years. It's really ultimately what TransferWise does, right? Which is to make it cheap, to make it fast and transparent. I think really that's really it, and people like it, and I can make all my transfers basically a cross-border transfer literally within 2 to 3 minutes.
Understood.
Yeah, so like I give you an example. I think there was the other day I had to make a payment transfer into Malaysia, and the other side received the money within 15 minutes. That is mind-blowing. You know, Malaysia is a restricted country, right?
Yep.
And to do that, like, and then the other guy was like, oh my god, what was this? I need to sign up also. So this, just because of this referral, right, it's so powerful. And this, if after a while you realize, because it's such an efficient acquisition strategy, the CAC is low, or what we call the customer acquisition cost is low.
Because of the wow factor.
Of the wow factor.
That makes people want to, holy dude, like what just happened? What is this thing you're using that allows me to get the money so fast?
And if the customers keep using the product,
yeah,
the lifetime value actually is not one time.
Yeah.
It's actually quite long and quite high.
Got it.
I'm not saying that it's infinite, but I'm saying it can be very long.
Okay, so we're starting to sound a little bit too bullish. So let's kind of parry back to neutral ground first. Okay, so let's go in a bit deeper. So now we've got the financials, right? We've got gross margin 66%, EBITDA, which is the profit adjusted margin, about 20+%. But let's go into the business. So from what I see in the investor relations, they have three types of product types. They have the Wise account, and then there's Wise business, and there's the Wise platform. So if you could just maybe give a one-liner for each one, what does each of these do and what is actually the product about? So we can start with Wise account first.
Okay. I think Wise accounts largely are for individuals in terms of supporting that. So like, for example, when individuals are making payments, you can have, again, accounts, multi-currency accounts to receive or to make payments, or to, let's say, I want to buy the FX first, store an account, and then maybe make their payment out later.
Got it.
So they can take, I guess, FX positions or
it's a little bit like a virtual bank account.
Like a virtual bank account from that standpoint. That is also supported by the debit cards. Now, then you have business, which is literally supporting small, medium businesses. Now, small, medium businesses, it's not just good enough to just do the payments. You need to have accounts, you need to support in terms of invoicing, payment, and now they've really expanded into the enterprise bit.
That's right.
Of really recording bit. Because that is also, you know, you need to do all of that to really support that. And I think that's where they have been growing rapidly and transiting, taking that business away from the institutional banks, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. The last one is really interesting. I think supporting what we call bank cross-border transfers via an API.
So that's Wise Platform, is it?
Wise Platform, okay. Exactly. So they've been finding like what we call like neobanks. So they've done like, they have clients like Monzo, which is in the UK, and they're basically using Wise to make all the currency conversions, because it just doesn't make sense for them to build their own, to offer all of this for such fintech platforms, basically. Mm. And that becomes truly amazing, because every single thing you go through goes through Wise's architecture. Mm. And as long as they make sure that every dollar is revenue and profit accretive,
yes,
it eventually goes down to the bottom line. And those, when you, it might take long gestation periods to set up, but once it sets up, it becomes tremendously can be quite powerful.
Got it.
But then again, this will not be the big banks.
Yeah.
Because the big banks will have their own.
Yes.
It will be what we call mostly the smaller tier banks. And I think that's where really and I would say the upcoming fintechs as well.
And I want to double click on the business segment. So looking at their financials, the bulk of their customers and also revenue as of now is still coming from the personal side, the personal space, which is just the individuals to individuals, right? But their higher growth rates are coming from the business side of things. Am I right to say so?
This is very interesting, Gav. Yeah. Right now, about 5 million customers.
Yeah.
About 4.7 million of them are individuals.
Yeah, the individuals, correct? Right? Yeah.
So you have business about 300K.
Mm.
But yet, at the same time, the volumes, it's almost, I would say, if I remember, I couldn't remember, I don't have the exact number here over here, mm-hmm. but it's not too different in terms of revenues.
Yes.
Because the enterprise themselves spend much larger and in much larger sizes.
For obvious
reasons. They spend larger sizes, the tickets, and then they do a lot more transactions.
And it's actually faster growing.
And it's faster growing. Yes. So to me, I mean, for me, the investment thesis really, it's the enterprise growth story over the individual growth story. Because firstly, the enterprise TAM is larger, the enterprise is growing faster, and with accounts, it is stickier.
Mm.
Much more stickier. Because with individuals, most of the time when we get the money, right?
Yeah.
We transfer back to our local bank accounts.
Mm.
Some might try to stay there. Wise might probably need to do something to pay some interest. But on the business side, they do all, like always say, the cash flow management for this. So it can become very, very sticky.
Yes, because now it's kind of lodged there with the money. And for businesses, you don't really transfer that often as an individual, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So for businesses, when you do it, it becomes more recurring. So you actually end up, it actually strengthens the stability of the revenues.
I like it. So this is the thing I want to go in a bit deeper, right? Mm. So they are able to achieve this amazing kind of lowering of fees, because I think one thing I kind of came across was, please correct me if I'm wrong, right? Mm. They actually fix their exchange rate for certain particular periods. Am I right to say so, based on what I read so far? So so the point what I was trying to say is that, so if Wise, they kind of fix the exchange rates a little bit for the customers, then wouldn't they bear a little bit of foreign exchange risk when the currencies move, but they kind of fix it a little bit for the customers?
Correct.
Yeah.
So Wise does a fair bit of natural hedging from the standpoint.
Yeah,
so I think this is a crucial point, because if you think about it, most of the global FX markets trade 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so your euros, your yen, your sterling pounds, they're all 24 hours.
Yeah.
Now, not every country trades like that. So like if you look at dollar BRL, like dollar Brazilian real, it only trades during onshore Brazil hours.
Yes.
It doesn't trade outside of that. So then you have the closing rates. And so what Wise does is that basically Wise uses the closing rates and applies basically that. And use all of that, basically.
Mm.
So there will be that risk, and they have done a fantastic risk management from the standpoint. So there will be, I think most of their, the balance sheet basically says, most of their hedges are naturalized.
Mm.
And when they can do all this, they basically do FX hedging.
Okay.
I don't know exactly whether, how do they do it, because like Brazil's, you probably might do some non-deliverable forwards, what we call NDFs, to kind of proxy the risk. So it depends really on the notional. But I guess the example is, they probably will have thresholds internally. And I've seen their risk management, they do have thresholds internally. So if I'm making a $10,000 BRL payment, even if the FX move 1%, it's going to be $100. It's not really going to drastically move the needle.
Mm.
But of course, if you have fat tail events that keep happening like that, and there's a big movement of fee of transfers, then it can be tricky, right? So I think they have thresholds.
Yeah.
They have treasuries that manage this 24 hours, and they know when those thresholds are breached, they need to go out to the market to do it. If not, basically, they'll let the flows internalize. And it's better to let the flows internalize from that standpoint rather than to go out to the market and do that.
Understood. Okay, cool. So I think before we go in a bit further, because I want to push into the risk section, because I think the last 15 minutes have been a bit more bullish, but I just want to do a quick recap first. So basically for transfer-wise, the main mode we're talking about here, there's a few, but number one is what you mentioned is network effects, because the more people want to do transfers in that currency, the more popular it becomes, and it kind of allows them to lower their costs as well because of the infrastructure they can create in that country whatsoever. That's number one. And number two, their skill economy is shared because of the fact that if they actually get more volumes, they can, and their cost infrastructure is fixed, they can return a lot of more of the profits back to the customer. And their take rate is actually pretty amazing. So there was this diagram I was seeing. In 2019 financial year, the take rate was 0.64%. It's fluctuated around that to 0.7%. Now it's at about 0.61% in the latest quarter. So it's actually trending downwards gradually. So would you say those are mainly the moats, just to double check on that?
Yeah, I think the one to just add on to the first moat is really the local liquidity pools that enables the first moat, which enables the network effects, right? Because you don't have the local liquidity pools.
Yes.
That is really the infrastructure. That
allows the money to not have to cross borders, right?
Exactly.
Okay, cool. So yes, now that we know the strengths of that, so let's talk a bit about the potential risk that you foresee. So we've covered the foreign exchange risk. We've covered a little bit about why can't PayPal and banks come in to eat their lunch. So what else do you see that could kind of maybe destroy or kind of shift the thesis a little bit?
The biggest risk, I guess, is if we go into a global depression, because I think the way to think about it is that they still have a very small market share, they continue to grow.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if they can't develop, on the product, they can't deliver on the product, let their customers or they continue to delight their customers, and they start going to another competitor, and do that. I think that will be the biggest moat. And you will see, I guess, when say quarter on quarter, if there are declines and stuff.
Mm.
But I think more importantly, when we need to differentiate if, for example, let's say if the broader economy is slow and maybe on the individual side, the growth is not as big or not as fast, right? Or maybe when that... So there are probably some times where, you know, on the individual side, it could be more subject to more macro. But I think overall, if directionally, if that trend continues to stay elevated, I think that can be a very strong growth trend. On the business side, I think if they continue to keep acquiring new customers, customers keep doing a lot more FX, and business continue to grow faster than personal. Because I think on the personal side, I think there are a lot of people using TransferWise. Like for example, in Singapore, I'm just doing an anecdotal check. A high percentage are already using TransferWise. So I'm not trying to say that the individual market is tapped out, but I think they need to grow the business side. Any key factors in terms of what I'm watching really is a massive deceleration, continued deceleration of the growth rates across a couple of quarters, not just one quarter or two quarters, I think. And that is more structurally due to the business rather than due to the macro, because that means they're not doing something right and competitors are probably coming in. I think that's really my biggest... I think it's really execution here, really. Okay. If they continue to keep doing what they're doing, I think... That in my mind.
Yeah, because the product is proven, they have very, very good market fit, because otherwise there wouldn't be a 66% referral rate, right? So it's more like an execution risk here. Okay, fantastic. So yeah, before we go into valuations, I want to kind of just do a side tangent. So I think, because I've known Eugene for a while, you are very, very knowledgeable in the payment space and industry. So I just want to ask a quick question. So how do you, it's going to be more like 50,000 foot view, how do you foresee the payments industry kind of evolving from here on? Because from these conversations I'm seeing, and it's not just about TransferWise, right? You talk about like Adyen and stuff, which we'll not get into right now. There is a lot of bypassing of middlemen, banks, all these traditional institutions. Even the entire crypto space is in a way a metaphor for that. So how do you foresee the payment space will evolve in the coming decade? Like, will there be a lot of just these middlemen being wiped out and fees just being lowered to the point where it's just full transparency? What do you think?
I'm no prophet, just to say first. So I think what I can do is just try to give a sense of what I think, right? I think the broadest theme is really the war on cash. So in terms of payments, we're all moving from, you know, checks, cash, physical cash and coins, really to something that's electronic. We've done that through what we call Visa and Master in terms of or American Express on the rails, which is like your credit cards and debit cards.
Yep.
Now, of course, you can have a buy now later as an alternative rail as well, or what we call BNPL. Now, you have different routes. Where I see payments in this perspective is really going to be cheaper and faster. And this was exactly what the CEO Christoph actually said in his recent interview. And I think that's really how I think payments is going to be. You must understand that payments, because when you're enabling something, I don't think, because of the infrastructure, that actually drives certain advantages. And I think because of that, it's not going to be a perfectly competitive market.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, for example, in credit cards, you have literally an oligopoly.
Yes.
Right? Outside of China, ex-China, you literally have Visa, Master, and Amex.
Yeah.
Right? Amex slightly different because they do hold the, you know, the customer balances on their books. But Visa and Master purely just toll booth for transactions, right? And if you look at, for example, in enabling payments, electronic payments on the corporate side, you have Stripe and Adyen. And of course, you have dLocal and a couple of other guys. And you will always need someone like Wise to make the cross-border transfers, right? So I think everyone plays a specific role.
Yeah.
I don't think I think Wise would take some time for Wise to become the dominating dog. I think there will be some local guys who will come up and have that
for sure.
For sure, and I think that will be the way. But I think nobody can come in and try to burn and try to get market share, because eventually if they get it and it's not sustainable, it's going to be long. And I think that I think Wise could probably sustain its lead a little bit more.
And the customer satisfaction also is very crucial. Right?
Very, very crucial. So if customer satisfaction drops, that's going to be. Mm. So I think really payments faster, cheaper. Mm. And interestingly, I think also we have talked about a lot of it already on credit cards and debit cards. Increasingly, a lot of our payments are already on local payment methods.
Yes.
So actually, you think, I mean, for me, 95% of it's already being done in Singapore or electronic.
Yeah.
I'm really doing very little, right?
Yeah.
So I think that trend is probably going to be more across the world.
Nice. Thanks for the prophecy down there. Well, we'll check back on this podcast like 5 years later and see what turns out true based on your vision. Okay, so last part, valuations. So yeah, how do we actually know whether it's a good price to actually invest into TransferWise right now?
So in terms of valuation, so I just want to share a little bit, right? So I don't really do what we call DCF valuations. So I don't do discounted cash flow valuations.
Understood.
When I think about investing in companies, I really don't think about present values. I think about forward, or what we call future values, right? So let me try to give you an example of how I think about this. So right now, for example, the trading 12-month revenue is around 560 sterling pounds, right? TransferWise has shown to grow almost, I would say, 30-35% over a very, 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 very consistently, very, very, over the last 3 to 5 years. And I think they can continue to do that.
Yep.
So let me just try to put some numbers across a range of values. And I prefer to think not in one value, but in a range of values, right? So if they grow, for example, revenue CAGR over the next 5 years, because we are long-term investors, anywhere between 25-35% CAGR, that revenue number from 560 million is probably going to go to 1.7 billion to 2.5 billion. Now, we know that current free cash flow margins are 20%. We know that the business clearly has operating leverage and definitely can grow further some more.
Mm-hmm.
So you assume very conservatively 20% free cash flow margins all the way from 20% to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us free cash flow from anywhere from 300 million to 800 million.
Okay.
Now, I want to run you through. Their current market cap is 5 billion.
Okay. I see where you're going.
So the far end, I just shared last night, was 8 billion.
Okay.
So 8 billion versus 5 billion. And if I just assume simple future multiples, this is going to trade at a premium.
Okay.
It will not trade cheap. Okay. Right? And let's assume multiples that anywhere range from market cap to free cash flow multiples at anywhere from 20 to 30, 40 X.
Okay.
That would probably get us to a future market cap of anywhere from 7 to 30 billion.
Just to check, your 7 to 30 billion, the lowest, the lower range, what multiple is it using? Just to
20x.
I see.
I think 20x for a 20% free cash flow
is very rare.
It's very, I think it's quite reasonable. I think it's let me put it.
Yeah, but I would presume it's more than 20 for sure.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's probably going to be more. If you're still growing at 30%,
yeah.
Which means their rule of They'll probably rule of 50, rule of 60, right?
Yes.
Then they will probably be trading even higher, right? So if I do that, if you can think about it, the future market caps are probably between 7 to 30 versus the current market cap of 5 billion.
Okay.
The IRRs are probably anywhere between 6% to 43%.
In the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think, that's how I think about it.
Understood. So I'll just do a recap for the listeners because there's a few numbers we're throwing out at them. And if you're listening to this on the treadmill or whatever, you may just get lost. So what you're using is you're using the 560 million revenue, which is in the latest financial year. And I know management also did guide that they foresee it being able to grow at least 20% year on year. But you use
30 to 35%.
Pardon me. So you use that revenue CAGR, revenue growth across the next 5 years. Am I right? And then you use the current free cash flow of 20%, you assume they continue to apply operating leverage. So that gets you to maybe conservatively about 30%. So you use 30% on that final revenue number of, was it 1.7 billion or something like this? Yep. So you get the final number and you slap a multiple of between 20 to maybe 30-ish about there. And that gets you the market cap compared to today's market cap in 5 years. The rate of return is how much roughly again?
Not for 40%.
Okay.
So we are obviously base case scenarios.
And ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, scenarios. It's not investing advice. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Correct. I think it's crucial that we just think about it, right? Because we really got to think about the North Star in terms of investing. Mm-hmm. And the North Star is, as I tend to always say, where revenues go, profits go, and cash flow goes, the stock price ultimately flows.
Yes.
Right? And I think that's really, 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 really the North Star. If they can continue to grow 30%, 20 to 30 plus percent for the next 5-7 years, I think at current valuations, it looks quite attractive.
And also, of course, I'm not a prophet here as well. Looking at their market share of 1% penetration, it's possible given the size that or the addressable market that they have up for grabs. Okay, so yes, coconuts, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, that actually is TransferWise. Any final words from you, Eugene, from where can my people find you? Vision Investing, is there a website? Is there a Twitter account handle they can follow you at?
Thanks a lot, Max. I think it's really a very delightful podcast, and as usual, you know, the deep dive and the questions that you're asking are thoroughly very, very insightful and very, very curious and very, very inquisitive. You can find me. I'm most active on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Eugene, EUGENENG_VCAP, called like Vision Capital. I do write a Substack, but not very frequent. I try to write it as meaningfully as I can, and therefore as enduring as I can, and more time, and rather than more being timely from that perspective. So you can find it at Vision Investing, .substack or something like that, along those lines as well. Yeah.
And he also has a fantastic book. You can check it out on Amazon. It's called Vision Investing, right? And I say that not just for the fun of it. I actually read the book, right? A lot of stuff on future growth investing in terms of buying the best companies for the future. All right. So with that said, thank you very much, and thanks, Coconuts. And see you next time.
Hey, Coconuts. So I hoped you learned something useful today. Definitely recognize that investing is a personal decision. We are not giving you recommendations here, but are always happy to geek out with you about different interesting companies and trends for the future. This series definitely has a lot more depth and terms, and we want you to tell us what stock to analyze. So if you have any feedback or ideas, do drop us a line through our socials or email us at hello@thefinancialcoconut.com. See you in our next episode.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.